we talked about so far in terms of calorimetry is just calorimetry in general, and also electromagnetic calorimetry. So we focused on that. And last time we finished with talking a little bit about what one makes a calorimeter out of. I'll finish up with that, some general comments. And then we'll move on to hadronic calorimetry, okay, which is a very important sort of complement to the electromagnetic calorimeter. So let's just think about the materials. So in general, we're talking about sampling calorimeters. Well, this would be true in general, but we want an absorber. We're going to have some situation where we're going to be alternating some absorber with some active material and some absorber and some more active material. So the absorber needs to, that's the thing that we're relying on to stop the particle and to absorb its energy. Okay? And then we're going to use the little bit that comes out of this that goes through our active material, we're going to try to read that out somehow. All right? So the absorber, we want to have something that's very dense. In particular, we would also like it to have the property that when a particle comes in here and showers, we would like this shower not to be too wide. Okay? The reason is that that will increase the confusion of when particles are nearby each other. They'll start to overlap and we won't be able to tell them apart. The other problem with actually having these showers spread out is that you've got more noise. The more area you cover, the more noise will be in that region of the detector. So you'd like it to be in as localized a region as possible. So what this means is you'd like to have a small, if possible, but at least not a very large Mollier radius. Okay? Now, so that's the absorber. And when we talk about hadronic calorimetry, we'll have some more criteria besides just being dense and have a modest Mollier radius, because hadronic interactions, as we talked about, I don't know, a month and a half ago, are very complicated. Well, we'll get to that. Now, in terms of the active medium, here, what we need is something that will be sensitive. Whatever these particles are that get produced, we need something that will be sensitive to the passage of these particles going through that material. Okay? And there are two primary ways. There are others, but there are two main ways that this is done. Either we can have something that's sensitive to ionization produced as these particles pass through the material. So these are the secondaries from, they're particles produced in the showering in the absorber, and then they just pass through this active medium. Okay? We want the particles to interact with this active medium in such a way that we can count them, essentially. Now, one way is to do ionization. Okay? The other way, so if we did ionization, this might be a gas chamber, like, some sort of ionization detector, like a wire chamber or something like that. Okay? We might also have not a chamber filled with gas, but we might have a liquid material. It might be a noble gas, which can get ionized, a liquid noble element, and which will get ionized as the particles pass through. Okay? So in one case, you might have a wire chamber. In another case, you might actually have the absorber immersed in a liquid. Okay? And an example of this would be argon. And liquid argon is usually abbreviated with a capital LAR. And that, well, I'll focus on that because both D0 and Atlas use that for most of, well, Atlas for most and D0 all of its calorimetry. The scintillator can be plastic scintillator, which is also used by Atlas, or it could be another scintillator where you have liquid in tubes, where you have scintillator, and that's actually how NOVA is used. I mean, even though we're talking about calorimetry and NOVA is like a gigantic calorimeter, I'm going to leave NOVA until we talk about particle ID because it's so much made to do that task, and you'll see that later. Okay, so we want to be either able to look at the ionization or these particles. Instead of having a wire chamber here, this thing might be a slab, a slab of scintillator. And so what's actually being produced by the passage of these shower products is scintillation light, not ionization. Okay? So these are the two different ways that we can be sensitive to whatever particles are produced here that make it into this active medium. And remember, not all the particles produced here will get here. We have a sampling calorimeter. Now, there is one consideration that's worth making note of, which is that the condensed media, liquid argon, and the scintillator, those two approaches have the advantage over the gaseous approach because of the fact that you don't get these very large variations in the ionization due to Landau fluctuations. So if you recall, when we talked about ionization, we talked about occasionally you'll get these really large fluctuations where you'll get a electron knocked off that then can cause more ionization, et cetera, et cetera. And you get that more in the case of the gas than you do in the case of the liquid or if the scintillator might be a solid. Okay? So that's undesirable because it ruins the resolution. So most calorimeters use some sort of condensed medium. So let's talk a little bit about scintillators. Scintillators, as I mentioned, you can have a variety of different types. You could have a plastic scintillator approach. This is actually also used, it's used in Atlas, but it's also used in part of CMS experiment. You could have this filled capillaries or filled tubes like in NOVA. But basically what you're doing usually is you're taking the scintillator and you're alternating it with absorber. And that's how you're building your scintillating calorimeter. Now, if you read in, I think, Gruppen and Schwartz, there are calorimeters where actually the scintillator and absorber are sort of much more enmeshed. It's not absorber, scintillator, absorber, scintillator. You can build something where you've got the scintillator sort of embedded in the scintillator embedded in the absorber. But, okay, it's the same basic idea. You only have some of the volume occupied by scintillator, and so you're only sensitive to some of the particles from the shower. With the case of the scintillator, and I'll contrast this a little bit with the liquid argon, in the case of the scintillator, you have some light-sensitive device, like a photomultiplier tube. That has a gain, a large gain, so that you can see the signal well. And when we talk about electronics, I'll touch on that very briefly, and we may have if I can convince him, we may have a guest lecturer try to focus on that. Otherwise, I probably won't have time. Now, the charged particles are observed, okay, and they produce a scintillation light. You don't see the neutrals, of course. In the ionization case, you don't see the neutrals either. One of the advantages of scintillation is that it's a fast signal, as we've said before. So you know, if you're in a situation where you have a very high interaction rate, a scintillator has that benefit to it. Okay. There's one issue with, for instance, if you use phototubes, photomultiplier tubes, if you're in a magnetic field, you may need to move them outside of a magnetic field. But, okay, I won't dwell on that. So that's scintillator. Now let's talk about the liquid noble gases. Excuse me. So you could use argon, krypton, xenon. These each have different properties, and one of the properties you care about is the drift time. One of the problems, even though liquid argon is used even in the case of Atlas, one of the difficulties that you have, and of course I'm going to list a lot of positives, but one of the difficulties that you have is that the drift time in argon is quite long. You're building an ionization detector, and you've got to wait for those electrons to finally get over to be read out to whatever your electrode is. And that can be a very, very long time compared to your interaction time, the number of times the amount of time between interactions. So that's a disadvantage. But there's a real advantage, and hopefully it'll become clear as we go. Well, first of all, it's an ionization detector, and this is a situation where you have a liquid. You put the absorber in it. They may just be flat plates like this. Actually, in the case of Atlas, in the central region, they're actually more complicated than that. You have sort of these wiggly-shaped absorbers, and then in between them, you have your liquid argon, okay? So this is called an accordion. This is done because no matter what angle the particle comes in at, this geometry tends to even out the detector's response to those particles. I won't dwell in on that, but it's this is how Atlas is done for the electromagnetic calorimeter. Most cases, it's just a simple sandwich. And the spacing, usually, you need to have enough of a spacing that when the particles pass through the liquid argon, they produce enough charge that you can actually see it. Okay, we're done with scintillation now. You need to be able to produce enough ionization that you can actually see it. So you don't want a gap that's too small, and then you also don't want a gap that's too large for a variety of reasons, one of which it will slow you down. So what you do is you take your absorber, all right? And so let's imagine this is iron or some other very heavy material, and this is an iron absorber. And then in this volume between these two, you filled it with the liquid argon, okay? So you just have two thick plates of absorber, okay? In the middle, you actually have an electrode. You have another conducting surface, okay? This may be a piece of non-conductor. Well, G10 is a material that's used. But whatever it is, it's some material that you then have, say, copper on it. And, if you were to look at a sheet of this stuff, what you can do is, it may all be copper, but you can then segment it so that this region is electrically separated from this region. Okay? So you have this, so there's a bunch of pads here. This thing is segmented in the transverse direction, okay? And what you do is you can apply a voltage between the absorber and that conductor, okay? So now you've set up an electric field in that gap. And it, again, this is an ionization detector. It's really not fundamentally different than what we talked about before. Now you've provided a way for electrons that get produced in this active region. We call it active because that's where the charge, or if it's a scintillator, the scintillator, where the stuff you're going to see or read out is where it gets generated. But in this active region, you've provided a way for the electrons to wander over to this pad, and then they get read out. Okay? So the electronics then is just off. So you just, so each one of these pads, you have to connect to your electronics. Okay? So you run the wires, and if we have time, we'll talk about that a little bit more later. This actually, there is a benefit here, which is that this is easy to do. You just cover the thing with copper, and then you just etch it a little bit, and you've segmented it very nicely and precisely, and it's very easy to do. Compared to what you have to do in scintillator, where you have to optically isolate every piece of scintillator, so they have to be covered, and or if you have a gas detector, we talked about how you segment that, and it's pretty complicated. Here it's very simple. You just have these pads. Now, the charge collection is just done by these particles traveling through the material, producing electrons, and then those collecting on this pad and then getting read out. One nice feature, this is as usual, the reason we use sometimes scintillator and sometimes liquid argon is because there's pluses and minus, pros and cons in each case. The drift time is really slow here, but the one thing that's nice is that you don't have any gain. Okay, you don't get a lot of electrons, so that's a bit of a problem, but your signal is just the number of electrons you see on this pad. It's a current. You see some number of electrons per time, it's a current. And that's it. You don't have to do, technically speaking, anything to, amplify that signal so that you can see it. Now, in practice, there is some electronics that you have to do, but even that is often preferable to the complication of phototubes, which are they're very complicated. One of the reasons we're not spending a lot of time on them. So you basically, the number of electrons you get is directly, as we've talked about before, telling you the energy. Okay? We already did that. And you're just counting those electrons directly. You're not doing anything that's a function of the number of electrons. You're directly counting the number of electrons. That's the current that you ultimately see come out. Now, you don't have a lot of charge, so since you have electronics noise later, you have to cool the liquid argon, okay, so to 80 degrees Kelvin. So now you need this big apparatus, all this cryogenics and pumps and whatever. So that's its own headache. You do have to put some electronics in here to amplify the signal a little bit and to do other things to it. And the other thing about liquid argon, which is, it would be true of any ionization detector used in this way, is that it's an ionization detector. You need to make sure that whatever you have, if it's argon, that you don't have impurities in the material, because what happens is, okay, let's step back for a second. Why are we using a noble gas? The noble gases are inert. They don't want to grab electrons wandering around unless they're ionized, which most of the atoms won't be. So they're not going to chemically interact. So when you produce the ionization, it will propagate without recombination in the argon. If, however, you have impurities in your argon, even the tiny, tiny amount, you will allow those electrons to recombine, and then you will lose signal. And not only will you lose signal, but you'll lose this very important feature of the linearity. Okay. And just to make it absolutely clear, because we talked about this before, but I'll just connect the dots. Linearity ultimately means that when I have a block of material and I have some energy, E, okay, whatever I do, I've got electronics, I've got a detector, whatever, I'm going to get some number, X. And that number is my estimate of the energy of that particle. Okay. What you want, your life will be much easier if naturally this is true. That if you were to plot what you call the energy versus the actual energy, that it's just a line. It's just got a slope. That's it. It's not, you know, it doesn't saturate, or it doesn't have some nonlinearity at the low end. It doesn't have any of these complicated features. It's just a constant. Okay? And it is very important. Remember, we're not using the geometry of hits to get a momentum like in a tracker. We have to bootstrap ourselves up from whatever we use to count electrons here through all of this electronics, however we do it, to something we called energy. And there's a lot of ways that that can be a problem. So purity can screw up your linearity. So you don't get this. You get something more like this. And then you're left with, okay, well, exactly what shape is that? Now you have to do all kinds of work to figure that out. It's quite painful. Okay? Okay, so now let's talk a little bit about energy resolution. Sorry, I have something in my throat. So energy resolution. Let me stop for a moment. I want to show you a couple things. We had talked before when we were talking about electromagnetic showers. This is a thought before I started hadronic showers. So we need to rewind for a minute. If you recall, we had a equation which gave the resolution of electromagnetic showers, which was proportional to this factor, S, square root of S over the sampling fraction. Okay? So I wanted to show this to you. This is many different experiments here. Okay? And you can see that this factor is ranging over about a factor of almost 5. And this resolution is varying over a factor of almost 5 as well. But what you can see, and these are different experiments, completely different everything, analysis, whatever. But it's basically a very close law that there is a proportionality between the resolution and this. This is the thickness of the gap, and then this is the sampling fraction. Okay? So, and ATLAS is somewhere in this region, the EM calorimeter, and D0 is somewhere up here, and I'm not sure where NOVA is. But in any case, this goes back to UA2, which is 30 years old at this point. So, all right. Now, Okay. So I want to make one other note too. We haven't started hadronics, so that's fine. I wanted to make one other note too, which is about energy resolution. So this is just the part of the energy resolution expression that we talked about before, the sampling, what we call the sampling term. Okay? So if you remember, there were three terms. There's a noise term, a sampling term, and a constant term. The sampling term was small, was the main one, was the largest one. The other two generally are fairly small. So if we just ignore the other two and we say, okay, well, the sampling term is our resolution, well, what you have here is the fractional resolution goes down as the square root of the energy. Okay? So that is very important because of the fact that when I have a tracker, the fractional momentum resolution, most particles are essentially massless in most of the particle physics experiments. They have very small masses. So momentum and energy are very closely related. But the fractional momentum resolution, sigma over p, goes up linearly with the momentum. If I double the momentum, my resolution goes up by a factor of 2. My fractional resolution goes up by a factor of 2. So if I have a 5% resolution at 10 GeV, at 20 GeV, I will have a 10% resolution. And it will get worse as I go up. In the case of the calorimeter, it goes down as the square root. So if I have a 5% measure of resolution at 10 GeV, if I go up by a factor of 2, my resolution will go down by the square root of 2. So I will have 3.5% measurement. So this makes calorimeters, even for charged particles, which you can see in a tracker, very, very important and very, very complementary to tracking. So even when you just care about electrons and, with charged particles, fine, and you have a nice tracker, whatever, you still have an argument that you may need a calorimeter because you're going to want to look at them at high energy, and at some point your tracker may not be able to get the quality measurement. And then the other point in terms of examples of liquid argon calorimeters, ATLAS, the electromagnetic calorimeter in the central region and all of the calorimetry in the forward region has iron plates. I got rid of it now, but has iron plates for the absorber, and then it has liquid argon active medium, and for D0 it's uranium plates and liquid argon. We'll talk about the relative merits of those two choices later. All right, what I wanted to get to today, hadronic calorimetry. So pretty much the discussion we had about electromagnetic calorimetry has many things in common with what you would talk about for hadronic calorimetry. There's a lot of similarities, and the reason is essentially that you're fundamentally going to be using the same mechanism, the same observables, the same processes to make a measurement of energy. And, of course, you're trying to stop the particle. The one problem is that for hadrons, when they interact with matter, they do not shower in the same way as electrons. And that complicates things quite a bit. And so that's something that we need to focus on so that you understand the distinction between electrons and photons on the one hand and hadrons on the other. So you're trying to stop a particle, though. You're going to measure the parameters, some parameter that correlates with its energy, just like we talked about a little bit ago. That is going to be either ionization or scintillation for the most part. And the other thing is that you here, because the hadrons interact in a very complicated way with matter, you will see that their resolution is not as good as electrons. It's much worse. It's very hard. It's much harder to get a good measurement of a hadron than it is to get one of an electron. And as a result, you don't gain as much by having a homogeneous calorimeter. A sampling calorimeter is just fine. So generally what you'll find is you have a sampling calorimeter for a hadron calorimeter. Okay? So the other thing, let's just keep in mind some generalities. I mean, most particles that are not electrons, positrons, or photons don't directly create an electromagnetic shower. And the directly in there is for the following reason. At the end of the day, if we're looking for scintillation or ionization, we are looking for essentially electrons to pass through the active medium and either to produce scintillation light or ionization. Or we're looking for some particle to do those things, I should say. But it's interacting electromagnetically. But in the case of hadrons, you don't necessarily get that situation we talked about where you pair produce if it's a photon, and then you each electron or positron bremsstrahlungs, and then we pair produce, and then we bremsstrahlung. We went through this cascade. You don't get that. Nor do you get the other thing where you have an electron, a charged particle, where you bremsstrahlung, and then the photon pair produces, etc. Why? Well, the hadrons are much more massive than the electrons. So they don't bremsstrahl. The charged ones don't produce bremsstrahlung. They just pass right on by the nuclei, and their masses are so much larger, they just don't do that. So that whole mechanism to create an electromagnetic shower doesn't happen directly. Now, we'll see that there's an indirect way that it can happen in some fraction of the cases, but in terms of directly, it doesn't. And the other aspect is when they do interact, what they do is they slam into a nucleus, and a whole variety of different things can happen. Nuclei can break up, whatever. There's particles that are produced in that interaction. And so that is the thing that actually introduces or initiates, I should say, a hadronic shower. Okay? Now, parts of that hadronic shower may then develop into an electromagnetic shower. But the initial thing that happens has to be this interaction here. You have to get it off to a start. Otherwise, if you're dealing with a pion, it's just going to travel through the material by ionization. It's going to be like a muon. It's just going to go right through. Okay? So one thing to keep in mind here, I mean, this discussion all relies on the chapter or the week or the unit, whatever you want to call it, where we talked about strong or nuclear interactions. Okay, so all that stuff about if you have this kind of interaction of a pion and a proton, what's a particle multiplicity that's produced? What is the typical PT of the daughter particles? That all comes into play here. Now, okay, so the initial interactions first of all, let's take the charged particles for a moment. A pion that passes through some material may travel some distance and just lose energy by ionization. So the beta block function may lose a little bit of energy here. It's not going to be much. The mass of the pion is pretty high on the scale of things. So it's not going to lose much energy, but it might lose a tiny bit of energy. But then at some point, it's going to interact with the nucleus. And then you're going to start, okay? Now, when it interacts with the nucleus, you get some secondary particles. And there's a whole... We went through the composition of these, so I'll just try to summarize it to remind you, because it was a while ago. There's charged pions, or the pi plus and pi minus. There's the neutral pion, the pi zero. There's kaons, protons, and neutrons. And there are actually nuclear fragments. So nuclei may actually just break up, and then you have to deal with that. So you may have an alpha particle or something like that. In the case of the charged pions, those themselves, let's say this is a charged pion, a pi minus, all right? This itself may lose some of its energy by ionization, but it's a pion, and it will interact with a nucleus. Okay? So that charged pion is just going to keep continuing to interact with another nucleus, produce some daughter particles, some secondaries, and et cetera, and et cetera. the pi zero decays to two photons almost immediately. And those, now let's say this was a pi zero. So it decays to two photons. Well, these two photons, they each have approximately half the pi zero energy. They're photons. They're going to start an electromagnetic shower. So right here, you're going to get a little electromagnetic shower wherever that pi zero was. Okay? And it will be governed by all of the showering exactly that we talked about before. And it's important to note that about one-third of the secondaries are of this type. So when we have a hadronic shower, one-third of it right away is actually an electromagnetic shower. Okay? Now, I'll come to this again a little more numerically, but just to give you some foreshadowing, this pion, some fraction of, when it interacts with the next nucleus, this pi minus, some fraction of its tertiary particles will be pi zeros. So as the shower progresses, the fraction of pi zeros goes up. Does that make sense? So I may start out here, about a third of my particles are pi zeros, but by the time I get a few interaction lengths down the road, I may have a significantly higher fraction of my particles be pi zeros. Or of my energy be in terms of electromagnetic showers. That's the better way to say it, because by this time this shower will be ended. But I deposited that energy by electromagnetic means. Okay? Okay. The kaons, pions, and neutrons each have their own way of interacting. The proton. The proton is relatively similar to the pion. The neutron isn't, and then the kaon as well. But let me focus on the nuclear breakup for a moment. Here, if I have a pion and it interacts with the nucleus here, that nucleus may break up. Let's say it's a uranium nucleus. Well, uranium is fissile. Okay? If I hit it with a hadron, that nucleus may turn into thorium or some other nucleus. Okay? And depending on how it goes, I may lose energy to the binding energy of this nucleus. Okay? And I have, of course, whatever products from that interaction are. So, and the other thing is, there may be, in nuclear interactions, there are some where you can have neutrinos produced. And the neutrino would just go right out the detector. I'll never even see it. So that, you know, here with the pi minus, I have some way of seeing it. It loses energy by dE dx. It might make a pi zero. It can have a nuclear interaction. This pi zero is easy to see. It's just an electromagnetic shower. But whatever energy that was carried away by the neutrino is just gone. I'll never see it. I can also have muons produced. So in this shower, I might have a pion produced that decays to a muon. Again, the muon, it does have a charge, it interacts with the material, but for the most part, it just passes out of the calorimeter and it's just gone. So I don't see most of its energy. Okay? So, and then the other reminder, so that's sort of, I mean, we covered this all before, but I was trying to remind you of what the shower looks like. Well, when we did it before, we didn't do it in terms of a shower. We did it in terms of hadrons interacting with each other. Now what we've got is essentially a fixed target experiment. We've got our calorimeter, and we've got a particle that's interacting with it, and then we're producing all of these products. The particle multiplicity that comes from these interactions is logarithmically dependent on the energy. Okay? and the typical transverse momentum relative to the direction of the incident particle, so PT is in this direction, is on the order of 1/3 the proton mass. But all of this stuff, perhaps most difficultly, but also the composition of this shower, is very difficult to model. You can see that this is much more complicated than an electromagnetic shower. To zeroth order an electromagnetic shower, you just need to know Bremsstrahlung and pair production. I mean, in the end, it gets more complicated than that, but that's a big piece of it. Here, it's all kinds of different things, in addition to Bremsstrahlung and pair production. Okay, so let's... what I want to get to is the performance of the detector in terms of how well you can measure resolution. But we should do what we did with electromagnetic showers and talk about how the shower propagates through the detector. So, first of all, the whole thing is the scale of how the shower develops is set by the absorption length. So that's the atomic weight divided by the Avogadro's number times the absorption cross-section. And the absorption cross-section is a function, if you recall, of the atomic weight. So actually, if you were to go through that, this absorption length is actually proportional to the atomic weight to the 1/3 power. So shower depth actually, even though materials tend to be denser with increasing atomic weight, you might think that would reduce the shower depth. But in fact, the shower depth goes up very slowly with atomic weight. And for large materials with a large charge, basically you end up with this situation. If we had an electron here, this is the depth. The longitudinal size of this shower is set by the radiation length for an electron. If we have a pion, it's going to be a much larger distance. And it's because when we were looking at this, what we saw was that absorption lengths are much larger than radiation lengths. Now, we could talk a little bit about it a little more quantitatively. We could take this shower here, okay? I mean, this is, you have to pardon my pretty terrible drawing ability, so. But okay, I mean, this is just meant to be an envelope where all the particles in the shower are. So you know, this is kind of shower maximum, and then, you know, it just sort of peters out, sort of goes away as you go deeper and deeper, okay? But we could define, let's just talk about two parameters. One is the center of gravity. So this is sort of just the half the shower is behind us and half the shower is in front of us, okay? Point. So we could talk about that. It would just abbreviate that COG. And we can also talk about a point back here somewhere where 95% of the energy has been deposited. Okay? Just to get an idea of what is the scale of the longitudinal size of the shower. So this is kind of, like where the middle is. And then this is just, how do I get all of it? They both vary logarithmically, and in Fernow and Gruppen and Schwartz use different conventions for their equations. In Fernow, he does these things in terms of number of radiation lengths and has an expression for the center of gravity. Gruppen and Schwartz don't. Gruppen and Schwartz do it in terms of centimeters, so it's an absolute scale, but then you have to scale it by the number of the absorption length for the particular material you want. But for the depth that you need to go to contain 95% of the shower, this is the relation. It's the absorption length of the material you're considering divided by the absorption length for iron times 9.4 times the log of the energy plus this constant term. So it's logarithmically dependent on the energy. They both are, okay? And x is just, I'm writing explicitly what is stated in words in Kirpin and Schwarz, but x is just the material. It may be lead. Okay, so this equation is, without that ratio, is valid for iron, but you can normalize it by the absorption length of lead or whatever, uranium or whatever material you're dealing with. Okay? Okay. Am I going too fast, or am I not? Do you guys have any questions? No? Okay. So that's the longitudinal development, but we also want to have some sense for what is the development in terms of width. So here, there is a big difference between hadronic showers and electromagnetic showers. So let me actually discuss that first. So this is a hadronic shower. It's a diagram of what one might look like. And what you'll see is you're punctuated by these points here, here, here. You know, particles just travel for a long distance, and then all of a sudden you get a bunch of particles. Okay? This is a much more clumpy distribution of particles than an electromagnetic shower would have. Electromagnetic shower, it's like you get two more times, two more times, two more times, two more times. You know. Here it's like, you know, no, and then boom, all of a sudden a whole bunch of particles. And then whatever. And then it's an electromagnetic cascade. Or here. Or here the thing traveled a while, and then all of a sudden you get all these particles. Okay? So it's much more clumpy. But the other thing is that these nuclear interactions cause these particles here or here to have significant transverse momentum relative to the particle that created them. And so this thing starts to spread out much more than if you have electromagnetic shower, okay, and it spreads out a lot. I mean, you could it's a bit of an exaggeration, but you have a large angle between these particles, and in fact, as the energy goes down, the angles can start to get worse because the size of the typical PT becomes larger. Yes. The main reason is that in nuclear interactions, you have things like nuclear breakup. You have the decay of massive particles. When I have a decay of a massive particle, now the mass of the particle, which may be hundreds of MeV or even more, it may be GeV, that mass can go into a momentum in the transverse direction. In the case of the electromagnetic shower, if I have an electron and a bremsstrahlung, that photon is basically in the same direction as the electron. I mean, not quite, but it's pretty close. And or in pair production, those two electron positives are very close. And the other thing is that there is some spreading in the electromagnetic case due to the fact that you have multiple scattering of, you know, electrons or whatever. But here, that's relatively small compared to just the spreading due to the nuclear interactions. Okay? Does it make sense why I'm saying the particle mass? Yeah. And you can also, the nuclei could break up. So, you know, you may have had a nucleus sitting here, but if it breaks into an alpha particle and something else, well, you know, I mean, that alpha particle may have a fairly high angle with respect to the other stuff. It's not a scattering, it's an inelastic process. Does that help? Okay. So you get these wide sours, and of course you see, I mean, I should dwell on it just to be, you see that you've got kaons here. These dashed lines are either neutrinos or muons because they're not seen. So you get a very complicated composition to this shower. Most of this stuff is pions, of course, but okay, I'll come back to that. Yeah, I'll jump ahead. So this plot is also an interesting thing. This is actually using, it's a simulation, but there's been a lot of study of this with detectors, but this is actually using the atmosphere as a calorimeter, basically a scintillation light or a Cherenkov light. But what this is you've got a 250 GeV photon striking the atmosphere, and you've got a 250 GeV proton. So one is an electromagnetic shower, one is a hadronic shower. And it turns out that the total size of these showers is not all that different in terms of longitudinally in this particular case. So we'd have to go back. I mean, the atmosphere is made of much lighter matter than lead or iron or uranium. So the relative size of interaction and absorption lengths can change. But what you can see is, first you can see this clumpiness here. This is a much more even distribution of particles. But also this particle is just a lot wider. Okay, and this is a pretty high energy proton. I mean, this is not, you know, a low energy proton. But and nevertheless, you get these very large angle particles. Okay? Yes. Yes. That's what I said. Not always. It's true. Not always. If you go back, I don't have my book with, but if you go back in either text, if you look at like hydrogen, something like Delosi, what you'll actually find is, I don't remember if they go down to the absorption lengths are less, but what happens is that the dependence on Z is different for absorption lengths and for radiation lengths. And so the disparity between those two changes. Now, without studying this in detail, I'm not claiming that that accounts for the similarity of lengths here, okay? But in the atmosphere, you have oxygen, you know, you have lighter materials than you have in a lead calorimeter or an iron calorimeter. In the lab, when we're building a calorimeter, yeah, we pick dense materials, high Z materials, but they tend to have, what that tends to do is produce a longer absorption length than a radiation length. You got to remember, I mean, this, let's see if you can read the units. It's true that the absorption length is longer than the radiation length, but they're both way smaller when I have a solid calorimeter than these showers. These showers are kilometers long, right? So what's happening effectively is that I'm shrinking the radiation length more than the, you know. Yeah. So again, I mean, I'd have to study this in detail. There's probably a lot more going on here than just that, but that is certainly got to be part of it. Okay? I'll copy the table and we could talk about it. But if you look, we talked about it some, the Z dependence of those things, and you'll hopefully see. Okay. So let's go back to the lecture. All right. So. So you get these large momentum transfers, and so you can get these significant PTs. I talked about all that. That's all fine. If one tries to come up with a expression which describes the size of these, you can simulate it or you can measure it in experiment. What you have here is, let's say we have a shower and we define a cylinder around the initial particle trajectory, and we say, well, the radius of this cylinder is W, the width. Okay? So the radius of this cylinder is the width that I would need to contain 99% of the particles, or the energy. And so it's, as usual, logarithmically dependent on the energy. This is the expression. If you put this in terms of GeV, this comes out in units of energy. Okay? And but then the other thing to say, though, is that because you have so many more processes going on than just bremsstrahlung and pair production, all these nuclear processes, all the things I talked about a little bit ago, there are really much larger fluctuations in the shower development and in the width of the shower. So electron and photon showers tend to be much more similar to each other than hadron showers. Hadron showers range over a very wide variety. And I can give you an example. You can actually have a situation where you have a hadron come in here, interacts with a nucleus, okay, and almost all of the energy goes to a single particle. If it was a pi zero, for instance, this would look like a electromagnetic shower. Now, that happens really, really, really rarely. But there are actually some hadronic showers that can look an awful lot like electromagnetic showers. Okay? So it's very rare. But it can happen. And then, of course, you have ones that are very different from electromagnetic showers. Okay. All right, so that tells you something about the evolution, longitudinal and transverse evolution of the showers. But the single most important measurement to come out of a calorimeter is the energy measurement. Okay? So we care about resolution and calibration. So to understand the resolution for a hadronic calorimeter, we've talked about it for electromagnetic case. To understand it for a hadronic calorimeter, the single biggest issue comes from basically understanding how much of this shower will be pi zeros. Okay? And not at any one moment. As I said, as pi zeros are created, they electromagnetically shower and then they're done. And the hadronic part of the shower continues to evolve and make more pi zeros, and then those shower and then they're done. And the hadronic part of the shower continues to evolve and creates more pi zeros. But at the end of the day, if you add it all up, the fraction of the pi zeros will be higher than just one third. You can take a simple situation. If you just start with one third of the secondaries from an initial hadron are pi zeros, then of course, on average, half the energy will be in electromagnetic cascades. And the other two thirds won't, because you'll get them in these two photons. Now consider the next step. Then one third of the hadronic energy that's left will get converted into into electromagnetic showers. Okay? And it just keeps going. And then I go to the next step. Whatever's left after that, one third will go into and whatever. So the more iterations, the more number of interaction lengths I go, which really corresponds to the energy. Okay? As I have a higher energy, I will go deeper and deeper into the calorimeter. We saw that as my energy goes up, my shower goes deeper and deeper and deeper into this material. More and more interaction lengths. More and more stages of interaction. Okay? So in this simple model, N is just the number of, it's kind of the number of interaction lengths. Okay? So the more of these I have, this simple argument where, you know, one third of what's left gets made into pi zeros, I get this expression. And you see that the electromagnetic fraction goes up as n goes up. Now, this model isn't quite right. It's just kind of a way of thinking about it, hopefully, that helps you. people have simulated in great detail and also, of course, done experiments. And in fact, this, I should have a box around it, this expression is a pretty good expression for what happens to the electromagnetic content of showers. So it's just 1 minus this ratio E over some cutoff E sub zero, to the K minus 1 power. So these 2 numbers, E sub naught and K, are just empirical values. Okay? So for 2 materials, iron and lead, E naught is 0.7 GeV or 1.3 GeV, and K is 0.8 or 0.85. Okay? Well, this is only 5% difference, but it actually matters because it's K minus 1. So K minus 1 here is 0.2, here it's 0.15. So these are actually 30% different, okay, in this equation. So it's a little bit funny, but K minus 1 is negative. It's either the fifth power of this, the inverse of this ratio, or the seventh power, you know, the fifth root or the seventh root of this ratio. And so this thing goes up in this fashion, okay? And it's basically for the mechanism we're talking about. So, and as a rule of thumb, what you can see is that for iron, the EM content starts at the low energies, is higher than if you had a lead absorber, just from that equation. But the lead actually rises more quickly. Okay? Okay. And, of course, as I keep saying, this varies a lot shower by shower. You can have some showers that have very little electromagnetic content and some showers that are almost completely electromagnetic content. Okay. Why is that important? Why is that important? The reason that the electromagnetic content is important is that I know how to calibrate the electromagnetic content. I'm just going to count the number of electrons or scintillation photons that get produced in my sampling layers. That's it. I know how to do it. We already talked about that. Okay? So to the extent that I get electromagnetic showers in my hadron shower, that part I know how to calibrate. I'm done. I mean, kind of. But now we have to worry about the other part of the shower, whatever's left, okay? The non-electromagnetic component. This is very messy. So first of all, okay, we're talking about hadrons. Some of them are charged. Some of them are neutral, but not the pi zeros. We would be talking about maybe massive hadrons, neutrons, or whatever. But the charge ones, okay, they do lose a little energy by ionization. Well, we know ionization, kind of. But in the end, they're going to interact by nuclear processes. What we can't see, our detector, we don't have an easy way of detecting the result of those nuclear processes unless they produce a signature that we can see by ionization or scintillation or Cherenkov light. But those are all electromagnetic processes. We have to, at the end of the day, the shower, the stuff that's generated in the active medium has to become electromagnetic, either a bunch of electrons or a bunch of photons. Okay, so somehow the end result is to produce an electromagnetic signature. If we can't do that, we can't see it, literally. Okay? So, okay, well, some particles, certainly charged pions, produce ionization, and and they can produce pi zeros, which then go the way we talked about. But let's talk about stuff that's not so easy. Nuclear fragments. Nuclear fragments, when they're produced, so let's say in my calorimeter, I have an absorber here, and I have, why don't I clean this up a little bit? So if I produce here, here's my interaction. If I produce a nuclear fragment, here's my active layer. This is my absorber. Okay. If I produce this nuclear fragment, the problem is it doesn't travel far. It just goes a little distance, and then it's going to interact somehow with another nucleus, or it's going to form another atom, or whatever. It's not going to go very far. It's not going to get here. So I'm not going to be able to see it. So it's basically invisible. Long-lived particles like, neutron, an isolated neutron, a kaon, or even a neutrino, these particles, they might get produced, and they pass through the active medium, and they don't do anything. They just go right through it. Okay? So they may escape the detector, like in the neutrino. A muon, so this might be a neutrino. A muon, okay, the muon may produce a little bit of scintillation light. Okay? It may produce a little bit of ionization, just minimum ionizing. It's a minimum ionizing particle.